Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. Today my guest is Chris Hedges. His new collection of essays is called The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris, there's so much in this book and so little time. I'm just going to read some of the ideas and themes to you that I gleaned from your book and see what kind of comments you'd like to make about them. Here's the first one. Quote, "The fundamental problem in the Middle East is not a degenerate and corrupt Islam. The fundamental problem is a degenerate and corrupt Christendom," end quote. What are your thoughts on that statement that you make in the book?
Well, what we have done since the first Gulf War is scatter military bases around the Middle East, occupy two Muslim countries, and carry out proxy wars into other Muslim countries, Yemen and Pakistan. We have sat by and done nothing as Israel carried out saturation bombing campaigns in Lebanon and later Gaza. And on a kind of very fundamental level, Muslims are asking the obvious, which is, end the occupation. We don't want you on Muslim soil. And that is a far greater impetus towards extremism and terrorism than anything al-Qaeda has ever done. And I speak as someone who not only spent a year of their life covering al-Qaeda for the New York Times, but was part of the investigative team that won the Pulitzer for it. I know al-Qaeda very, very well, and I don't want to minimize the danger that they pose, but we have to strike at the roots of terrorism. If we continue to speak to the world in the language of violence, we fuel those who respond to us in the language of violence.
We are recording this interview just a few days after it was reported that Osama bin Laden had been killed in Pakistan, and I saw your piece that you wrote this week about that on truthdig.com, comments on Osama bin Laden.
I think the point that I spoke extemporaneously, and then the remarks were recorded and put up on the website, but I said, in essence, what I've said since 9/11, since the events of 9/11, which is that the best way to fight terrorism is to isolate terrorists within their own society. And after, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we had gone a long way to doing that. We had garnered the empathy of not only most of the world, but the Muslim world. And I was there at the time, who were appalled at what had been done in the name of their religion. And if we had the courage to be vulnerable, if we had built on that empathy rather than begin dropping iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East, we would be far safer and secure than we are today. We have been using incendiary explosive devices to send a message around the world for decades. When Robert McNamara in 1965 launched the saturation bombing campaign on North Vietnam that left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead, he said that he was doing it to send a message to Hanoi. Well, the hijackers of 9/11 learned to speak the language we taught them. Huge explosions and death above a city skyline. It was straight out of Hollywood. And the inability on the part of those running our foreign policy to stand in the shoes of the other, to see us as others see us, has rendered us deaf, dumb, and blind to our own violence, our own embrace of gross injustices and collective humiliation that we deliver every single day within the Muslim world. And in a bizarre kind of way, we're the best recruiting tool that these terrorist groups have.
So the whole concept of a war on terror is absurd.
Well, you can't make war against a tactic. Terrorism is a tactic. It's been with us since Sallust wrote about it in the Jugurthine Wars. It is a matter for intelligence communities, as we saw in the case of the effort to track down Osama bin Laden. It took them 9 years to do it. It took the Israelis at least 2 years to find the perpetrators of the massacre that was carried out at the Munich Olympics. And it is a matter for intelligence. It's using conventional weapons of war to fight anarchic and stateless groups of terrorists is a really bad idea. And the debacle in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, illustrates that. The invasion and occupation of Iraq was one of the greatest foreign policy blunders ever committed by the United States, totally disrupting the balance of power in the Middle East, making the Iranian regime, which is very hostile to American interests, ascendant within the Middle East. Saddam Hussein was never a threat to his neighbors, but much less to us. His military had been completely destroyed. It was a shadow of what it was after the first Gulf War. We drank deep from that very dark elixir of nationalism in the days after 9/11. And nationalism is a disease. The flip side of nationalism, well, nationalism is primarily, of course, about self-exaltation, but the flip side of nationalism is always racism. And we played right into the hands of the very forces that we're trying to defeat.
Chris Hedges joins us. His new book is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Here's another quote from your book. Quote, "We are and have long been the primary engine for radicalism in the Middle East," end quote.
Well, the utter indifference to the plight of Palestinians and to certainly after the 22-day aerial assault on Gaza. And remember, Gaza is defenseless. They have no air force. They have no heavy armor. They don't have any artillery. This wasn't a war. It was primarily murder. The failure to rein in Israel when it massively bombed southern Lebanon. The callousness of the American public towards the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who have been killed since we occupied the country, coupled with the fact that we are losing the war in Afghanistan. The Taliban now controls about 80% of the country. We have replicated the disastrous occupation of the Red Army, where we're bottled up in urban centers, but even then attacks are frequently carried out, even in the capital, Kabul, by the Taliban. And only about 20% of Afghans live in urban centers. Most of the population is at this point either in disputed territory or in territory controlled by the Taliban. We've marooned our troops in Afghanistan. They're completely dependent on the Pakistanis, as the Pakistani ports, in order to get any supplies in. Coupled with the fact that we can't afford it, that we're borrowing to maintain an empire and at home a level of consumption that we can't pay for. It's not a sustainable system. And we have to begin to radically rethink how we relate to the world. Otherwise, it'll implode.
Here's another quote from your book. Quote, "Liberals are useless."
Well, the liberal class in this society, and, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about this in my book, Death of the Liberal Class, has proved utterly ineffectual to thwart the rise of the corporate state. And I go all the way back in the book to talk a lot about World War I and the destruction of radical and populist movements through the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids and the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. And it was these popular movements that at one point made the liberal class indeed the political center. These movements were wiped out. The Wobblies, the old CIO, anarchist socialist, 1920, Eugene Debs, even from a prison cell, pulls almost 1 million votes. All these movements were destroyed. And the liberal class was disemboweled by being through the witch hunts, the McCarthyite witch hunts and the Red Scare and being soft on communism, so that it proved utterly ineffectual with the rise of the corporate state and the dismantling, in essence, of the New Deal. Liberals became neoliberals, whereby they embraced national security as the highest good and the permanent war economy as something that could never be challenged, which, of course, consumes 50% of all discretionary spending. Now, the death of an effective liberal class is catastrophic for a democracy because it serves as a kind of safety valve, a mechanism by which incremental and piecemeal reform is made possible. And when it doesn't work, your underclass has no way within the structures of power to redress grievances and injustices. So you have 6 million Americans who are thrown out of their homes because of fraudulent and criminal activity on the part of banks and financial institutions. And yet there's no moratorium on foreclosures and repossessions. 1 million people a year go bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills. 40 million people at this point live in poverty. Tens of millions of people live in a category called near poverty. 1 in 6 American workers do not have jobs. And yet all of the resources of the federal government are directed upwards towards Wall Street and directed towards institutions that don't pay taxes. Bank of America gets $45 billion in bailout funds from taxpayers and hasn't paid taxes for 3 years. Neither does General Electric. I mean, the list goes on and on. And that is very dangerous because the rage, and it's a legitimate rage, and the feeling of betrayal, and it's a legitimate feeling of betrayal, is directed not only at government, but at a liberal class, and in particular a Democratic Party, that once watched out for the interests of working men and women. So when you see anger expressed in movements like the Tea Party movement towards the liberal class, it's an anger I share. Unfortunately, with that comes a discrediting of the very liberal values that liberals like Obama or self-identified liberals like Obama or Clinton purport to defend but do not. And your backlash becomes not only a right-wing backlash, but in many ways an anti-democratic backlash. The collapse of liberal institutions within any democratic state, and you can look at Yugoslavia, which I covered for the New York Times, would be an example, coughs up from some very frightening political distortions, like Slobodan Milosevic. I mean, it was, of course, the collapse of liberal institutions in Weimar that vomited up Adolf Hitler, or go back to the breakdown in Tsarist Russia that opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks, and we're not immune from that.
Chris Hedges joins us. His book is The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. You just mentioned that healthcare costs are bankrupting Americans. We have a national healthcare plan that's going to supposedly go into effect in a couple of years. Your thoughts on the plan? You write about it in the book.
Well, it ended up 2,000 pages, written by corporate lobbyists. It ended up being the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries, $400 billion in subsidies. It does nothing to protect the elderly, the sick. Premiums and copayments can be jacked up. We've watched the Obama White House hand out exemptions because these corporations don't want to cover chronically ill children. On a moral level, it is legally permitted in this country to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. Capitalists should not be allowed anywhere near health plans. If you get sick, you're not a consumer. You're not a client. Nobody chooses to be ill. And certainly nobody chooses to be chronically ill. And I've lived in countries, Switzerland, France, that have national health plans, and there are many different configurations. The Swiss plan is actually private. It's just controlled, heavily controlled by the government, that work, and ours doesn't. And I think one of the most egregious examples of how corporations dominate our debate is that groups, nonprofit groups like Physicians for National Health Plan out of Harvard, that which is made up of doctors, who have laid out how much more efficient, because, of course, I think it's about 40% of what we pay into goes in towards corporate profits and administrative costs. It doesn't go into providing health. How much more efficient it would be to have universal, not-for-profit, single-payer health care for all Americans, which is why, of course, the corporations effectively destroyed the public option, because they didn't want it as an option, because it works.
Our politicians love to make speeches about how we're bringing freedom and democracy to other countries. Are we living in a democracy here in the United States?
I think we're living in a system that the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin correctly calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that he means it's not a classical form of totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have seized internally all of the levers of power, rendering the citizenry impotent. What we've undergone is a coup d'etat in slow motion, and we've lost. And I think that there is example after example of that. You can go all the way back to the first bailout package, $700 billion. Constituent calls were 100-1 against the bailout proposal across the political spectrum. Some of the most impassioned speeches denouncing it were delivered by right-wing Republicans on the House floor. And yet it passes anyway. Why? Because the financial institutions, and in particular Goldman Sachs, wanted it passed. There is no way within the American political system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. It's impossible. The FISA Reform Act is another example, which retroactively made legal what under our Constitution is illegal. The warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping on tens of millions of Americans. And that was a bill that, as a candidate for president, Obama said he would go back to the Senate and filibuster. But the telecommunications companies, in particular Verizon and AT&T, came in with their lobbyists and their money, and because they had they were facing several cases in lower courts that they would have lost because it's a clear violation of the protection of privacy under the Constitution, and they got it passed. The Obama administration, the tragedy for me of the Obama administration is that they've codified the destruction of both domestic and international law that was put in place by the Bush administration. And they service an oligarchic elite at the expense of ordinary working men and women.
Chris Hedges is our guest. His book is The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. And it's a very interesting collection of essays. It's amazing how time and the news cycle is just so incessant. You've got essays in here about President Mubarak in Egypt, now deposed. You've got essays in here about our cult of celebrity, which distracts people so much from the reality that we're living in, how we're spoon-fed all this celebrity news. And I don't think he's mentioned in your book, but I think he's very much a part of this. And I'm wondering what you think of Donald Trump.
He's a hard figure to take seriously. And yet, because government is broken, because it no longer responds to the needs of ordinary citizens, a figure like Trump has a kind of appeal. And that's what happens when government no longer works. This was something that obsessed Dostoevsky. His novel Demons is about the death of liberal institutions. That's what Notes from Underground is about. It's about the defeated dreamer, the person who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and has now withdrawn into cynicism and disgust. And as Dostoevsky pointed out, when that happens, you enter an age of moral nihilism, where figures who would, within a functioning democracy, be considered buffoonish, like Trump, have a kind of credibility because the formal structures of power no longer respond to the needs or the rights of the mass of citizens.
You talk about places where you find sanctuary, and in one essay you talk about how you like to go up into the mountains, and there's another one where you say, number one, you don't have a TV set, and number two, you have thousands of books, and how books are so important. They're really a sanctuary for you, aren't they?
Well, I remain rooted in a print-based culture, while most of society is shifting to an image-based culture. And these images are controlled by corporations that feed you that mantra that reality is never an impediment to what you desire, that you can have everything you want if you just dig deep enough within yourself, if you focus on happiness, if you grasp that you're truly exceptional, if you believe that Jesus can carry out miracles. And that's magical thinking. It creates a society that's deeply illusioned. And there's a large difference between a dream, which you strive towards, and an illusion, which you live in. And when you live within an illusion, you remain in a state of infantilism, perpetual childishness. But as that gap opens up between the illusion of who you think you are and where you're going and the reality around you, when it's your house that's foreclosed, when you grasp that job that you once had, or maybe your father had at a steel mill where he earned $50 an hour and a pension and benefits, and health insurance, where he could support a family of four and maybe even send his children to college, that's not only gone but not coming back. And it's not coming back not only for you but for your children. When all of that happens, when maybe you go bankrupt because you can't pay your medical bills, then you react as a child, which is to scream for a demagogue or a savior, for moral renewal, for vengeance. And I think that we are probably the most deeply illusioned society on the planet, unable to see, even though in states like Ohio it's staring you in the face, the disintegration, not only of our manufacturing sector, but of our communities, our cities, our lives. And as this happens, we still chant the mantra that we're the greatest country on earth. And this is really dangerous, because if we don't face what's happening, if we don't grasp the reality around us, if we remain locked within an illusion, then when that illusion bursts, you hear some very frightening political and social consequences.
Chris Hedges joins us. You've made a statement over the years that always resonates with me, and it is, quote, "War is the pornography of violence," end quote. we are living in perpetual war. Why is that important for some people?
War, you know, it has different effects depending on where you are. For those who are at home, it provides a kind of narrative of empowerment or feelings of empowerment, especially as you lose actual personal and economic power. It provides a narrative by which we impose our virtues on the rest of the world by force. For those who are engaged in it, as I was a war correspondent for almost two decades, it functions as a kind of drug. It functions the way a narcotic functions. Unfortunately, we have chosen to speak to the rest of the world largely through violence. That's the way we communicate. And Thucydides understood it when he wrote about the collapse of the Athenian Empire, that empire ultimately is a disease, that the tyranny you impose on others abroad, you finally impose on yourself at home. And it was that which killed Athenian democracy, just as the mechanisms of empire, the permanent war economy, which consumes half of all discretionary spending, the surveillance and security state, which has become ubiquitous throughout our country, are the mechanisms that are snuffing out what is left of our anemic democracy.
The book is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Chris Hedges wrote it. It's a collection of essays. And Chris, we really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Some of you are probably in shock after that interview with Chris Hedges. He is a fierce, fierce interview. That's the fifth time I've interviewed him, and he's an amazing guy, and he really believes in what he's saying. Tune into the Book Nook next week when we revisit the 17th century and Martha's Vineyard. My guest will be Geraldine Brooks. She's written a novel called Caleb's Crossing. It's about a Native American who went to Harvard College back in the 17th century. His name was Caleb. It's based on a true story, but very little is known about the real Caleb. And so Geraldine Brooks uses her creative zeal and imagination to craft an exquisite novel. That's Caleb's Crossing, right here in the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for listening. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.